Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet, by webcast and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Return of the Unexplained. Oh, we're in the dog days, if that's the right phrase, of winter at the moment. We've had the snow, and we've had the big freeze, that some parts of the media said was going to go on and on. And suddenly it seems to have stopped as I record this. And it has got, it's still cold, but it's grey and it's wet. And it's the kind of weather that I really hate. I like to see the sunshine. So it's just, you know that. If you've been listening to me for long enough, you know that I just love clear skies, nice warm temperatures and sunshine. And the winter up here is a thing that is just, it has to be endured, I think, is the phrase that I need. Thank you for those emails. If you're having issues still with the new website or with actually getting the podcast version of the show, let me know. I think we've returned now to all of our portals, including the internet radios. But in case you're not receiving it, then please let me know. Go to the website. If you want to contact Adam Cornwell, my webmaster, you can follow a link and contact him directly from there, and he can sort out technical issues that are way above my pay grade. A lot of this stuff I simply don't understand. I know about broadcast technology, the internet, and how you make websites and get podcasts out. A lot of that stuff, although I'm learning all the time, is just a foreign language to me. So Adam knows. You can email him. Through the website, you'll see a link to Webmaster. If you want to contact me, then you can get me at mail@theunexplained.tv. That's M-A-I-L @theunexplained.tv. And thank you if you have emailed recently. It's lovely to hear from you. If you've made a donation recently, thank you very much indeed for doing that. And, it's always worth considering. Take a look at the little spiel on the website there with the picture of the coffee cup. I love that. It took us ages to find the right coffee cup motif, I think is the word, to put on the website. And I'm rather proud of that one. So if you can make a donation, please do. And if you have, thank you very much. And if you can't, that's fine. Enjoy the show. The guest on this edition of the show is somebody that we had on the radio edition of the show. And we didn't really have enough time to have a relaxed conversation with him then. So I wanted to bring him back here, where we don't have to get to commercial breaks or get to news. I don't have to speak to exactly 57 minutes, 48 seconds, or whatever I have to hit and make on the radio. All those disciplines that you have. Of course, here online, we don't have to worry about any of that. We can just talk. Richard Martini. We're going to talk about the afterlife. He's written about this. The man is originally a filmmaker, pretty well known, and now well known for talking about subjects like this. It is the ultimate enigma, the ultimate challenge, and I was listening to one of Art Bell's old shows yesterday, and ironically, I picked it up at the point where he was talking about not knowing what comes after this existence that we now live. And now, of course, he knows the answer to that. As we will all discover in the fullness of time. I have to say, I'm still very much feeling the void left by Art Bell and the fact that my guide and mentor, even though a lot of those things he probably didn't know, is no longer here. The compass, the yardstick that we all had. But I have talked about that before, but, it's coming up to a year anniversary now. Where's that year gone? And still missing him like anything. Okay, let's get to the guest, West Coast of the USA. Richard Martini will talk, among other things, about the afterlife on this edition of The Unexplained. Rich, thank you very much for coming back on the show.
Thank you, Howard. Good to hear your voice.
Before we get into all of it, I think we need to do this bit, mainly because I just want to get a vision of somewhere that's not here. How's the weather? Is it really beautiful? Go on, make me feel really bad and tell me how beautiful the weather is in California right now.
I wish I could. Actually, it's English weather.
Oh.
It's drizzly, and it's been this way for 2 or 3 days. And we haven't quite gotten to the deluge yet, but so far, so good.
Okay. Well, I suppose you have to get it sometime. My challenge in life, and we're all born into this world, I think, to face different challenges and hopefully nail them or not, as the case may be. And I think my challenge was to be born here and have to endure the weather that we have to endure. It could be worse. Could be living in the Ural Mountains, I guess, where it's a lot colder than here. But just interesting to hear the weather report. Some of my listeners love to hear those weather reports. Some of my listeners tell me that they don't want to hear them. So you will know this. You cannot please everybody all the time.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't you have a past life in California?
Well, I think, we have to say we did a radio show together a while back, and I think in passing, en passant, I did mention that from the age of three and up to the age of about five, I used to tell people, even without them asking me anything about myself, I would always volunteer it, that I was from California. And then many, many years later, 2001, actually, just before Christmas that year, I had the chance to go there, and I felt completely, totally at home. But then, you know, I guess most people do, but I felt totally at home, and I actually felt that parts of it I had seen before. There was a familiarity about parts of the Pacific Coast Highway, and I found that strange. Not scary, not spooky, just strange.
What specific town were you in?
What's the name of that place? For part of it, San Diego, down at the bottom end of the highway. And then there was some traveling up further north, back towards Los Angeles, but not going up that far, but up to La Jolla, and then beyond there. And I remember going to a place, is it called Carlsbad, and having dinner in Carlsbad?
Sure. But tell me, what was the place along the route that had the most resonance for you? Was it San Diego?
San Diego, yes, but there was a place with a lot of boats, and it was like obviously thin strip of road and a yacht harbor, and I'm trying to remember the name of that. It's something like Angels or something like that, whatever that. But whatever that place was, that's where I felt at home.
So you felt, you had a feeling of having been there before, correct?
Yeah, and not just because I'd seen it in the movies.
Right. I know the feeling. And listen, it's happened to me a number of times in life. It happened to me when I first arrived in Rome. I had that feeling of, oh, you're home. And at the time, I was 19 or 20 years old. I thought, where did that come from? And the second time that it happened to me was flying into Mumbai. I was going into Bombay back in the 1990s. And there's a runway. Runway 7 has like a million people living on it.
Yes.
Oddly. But as I was landing, I felt, oh, you're back. You've come back. So I've had that experience a number of times in my life, and I've also talked to people about it. So, you know, just to talk a little bit about who I am or my journey and my path, as we talked about on the radio show before, I'm a filmmaker, basically, and trained to be. And I've written and or directed like 8 theatrical feature films. But somewhere along the line, I became close friends with an actress named Luana Andrews. She was an Easy Rider. And we were close for about 20 years, let's say. And when she passed away, she started coming to visit me. And that became the source of my book, Flipside, which if she could be visiting me, that means she exists. So,
well, it may mean that she exists within your consciousness, within your memory, within your brain. But that, a skeptic would say, is not proof that she actually still exists. She exists within you, but maybe she did not exist externally. What was it that persuaded you that it was the latter, not the former?
New information. So if you have a certain memory of a person, let's say an age, so I met her when she was in her late 30s. And like I say, we're together for 20 years. And so when she was appearing to me and I could hear her voice and see her, she was in her 20s. I recognized her instantly from who she was, but it was not the person that I knew since she was on the planet. You see, we didn't meet until she was much older. And so it's one of these conundrums that you learn about in this research, is how people can appear to someone as a younger vision. I'll give you an example. When I was working on the film Salt with Angelina Jolie, I was talking to people about this documentary I had started called Flipside, and I was pulled into an office by a New York police detective who said to me, you know, I heard you talking about past lives, and I heard you talking about the other side, and I think my house is possessed. And I said, why do you think that? He said, my daughter claims that she sees a ghost, and now she's talking about reincarnation. So where does that come from? And I said, let's break it down. Who's the ghost? He said, my partner died 10 years ago, but he said, I took out a photograph of my partner. And she said, that's him, Daddy, but he's younger now and he has hair. He wanted to know, because his daughter was only eight. You know, his partner died 10 years ago. How could this guy be appearing that way? And I said, well, look, it's in the research. People say that you appear however you'd like to appear. So if you want to have hair and you want to be thinner, that's the way you remember yourself the best. And that's how. So I said to him, but wait a second, did you like this guy? He said, I loved him. I said, well, then is it so bad that the person you loved is keeping an eye on you and your daughter? He said, "Not well, when you put it that way, it's not such a bad thing." And then I asked him about the reincarnation thing. He said, well, his daughter said that she had died in Australia and they had never been to Australia. So I said, well, listen, just take out a map and show it to her and ask her. Ask her a question you don't know the answer to. And so he did. He came in the next day, pulled me into a room, locked the door, and said, I took this map of Australia and opened it up, and she pointed to Perth, which is a city he had never heard of. And she said, I died there during a famine. I had a whole family, and then I found you. And then she burst into tears. So what was interesting about the story for me is when you hear new information, information that you couldn't have thought of, you couldn't have imagined, he couldn't have imagined that his partner would be appearing as a younger, thinner man. Nor could he had never heard of Perth. So the point is, once you start lining up thousands of accounts, not just 10, not five, not a few that from your friends, but thousands. I've examined the thousands of cases from Dr. Helen Wambaugh. She had 2,000 cases that she worked with. People under deep hypnosis remembering previous lifetimes, remembering between lifetimes, why they chose this life. Michael Newton had 7,000 cases over 30 years.
Okay, so talking about Michael Newton, 7,000 cases is a lot of cases, and I'm sure that's, you know, lifetime's work. But how many of those cases had verifiable factors in them? Where, for example, I mean, just like your policeman friend, and the reference to Perth and a previous life and a tragedy that had happened there. In the cases that you're aware of, how many of them are you able to go back through time and actually verify that people described and events described happened?
Well, I'm like you, which is I'm a born skeptic. So when I hear somebody say, oh, I was born in 1610 and I was a captain of a ship in London, I will then look and do the forensic research to figure out what that is. In my career as a film guy, I've been hired on a number of films. Salt was one of them, where they use my skills at looking stuff up. I basically do a deep forensic dive into research and data, and I find all the possible places that you could find details about whatever the topic of the movie is. And in, what I do is the same thing. When I film these cases, I then dig down deep to find out, is it possible that what they're saying, what they're remembering? And don't, of course, memory is bad for us at all times. I can't remember what I had for breakfast yesterday. And, you know, we're talking about previous lifetimes. So at some point, there are highlights that you remember, but even those might be a little fuzzy or a little dim. In my case, and in terms of Michael Newton's work, I asked him this question. And, it, you know, and most of the hypnotherapists will say to me, well, look, the idea of the hypnotherapy session is to help people heal themselves, help them find some kind of a healing place. They're not there to forensically prove anything. You know, they're just trying to help the client. So why are you having these dreams? Why are you having this experience, et cetera, et cetera. And Michael Newton's first case, because he was an avowed skeptic, didn't believe in past life regression. He said there was a guy came in, had a shoulder pain. He said, take me to the source of your pain. And this guy said, oh, okay. It's 1916. It's the Battle of the Somme. I'm a British sergeant. Then I'm being stabbed by a German soldier. And in that moment, the guy's psychosomatic illness, which doctors had sent him to Michael Newton to do this kind of work, you know, to hypnotize him because they couldn't find a source. He said, oh, you cured me of my problem. Newton didn't believe him and took extensive notes. What was your mother's maiden name? What street did you grow up on? And he sent that off to the British War Office and learned that indeed this guy had died in 1916 and this person really existed. So that's how Michael Newton became somebody who did past life regressions. And it wasn't until the 1960s that a woman came in and said that she had a very lonely life, was very depressed, trying to find the source of her depression. And he said, well, take me to the source of your problem. And she said, oh, I'm in the between lives realm, and I'm planning my next lifetime with my friends. And I've chosen a lifetime without any of them so I could learn something on my own. And in that moment, she said, oh, okay, I understand. I can go now. And he said, wait a second. What are you talking about? Your life planning session. And basically, he closed his public practice. And for the next 30 years, just talk to people who could take him to that between lives realm where we plan our journey. And that's what his research was for 30 years, 7,000 people.
It's astonishing. So, and more people are not only interested in this, but more and more people believe that there is something in it. And they don't believe that there is something in it because of stuff they've read in the papers, but because of direct experience or the experience of people who are close to them. You know, I personally, if I was... Yeah. If I was asked, then I would say, there has to be something. This can't be all that there is. But there again, this is the human condition we're talking about. Maybe I'm saying what I'm saying because of fear. We're all afraid of dying. And the last thing we want to think is that this is the end of the story.
Yeah, I agree with you, except at some point, you know, you said the key word that you just said, which was experience. It's really about experience. When you have an experience with something that's otherworldly or outside the norm, you may parse it and say, well, that could have been anything. But it's an experience. And once you have the experience, I liken it to once I was talking to a bushman, somebody from South Africa who had never... He had left the country, come to the U.S. to lobby for water rights for his people. And we were sitting in the backyard of a successful music star's home, Jackson Brown. And the bushman pointed to a swimming pool and he said, what's that? And I said, that's a swimming pool. And he said, what's it for? And I realized... because he had no concept of the idea of jumping into a pool of water and paddling around. His whole life was looking for water. And I realized I don't have the words to describe swimming. I can't say, well, it's like falling, but, you know, it's slicker. Or skydiving, you know, yes, it's falling and it's flying at the same time. So these are words that you can't really ascribe to anything other than experience. When you experience something, then you know it. It becomes knowledge to you. So when you hear a voice of someone who died, or I'll give an example, my 3-year-old daughter, we were sitting in the living room and she came running out of the kitchen, 3, and said, Grandpa's in the kitchen. Now my father had died 3 or 4 months earlier. But instead of jumping up and running into the kitchen, I realized, well, she sees him, I can't. And I said, what does he want to say? And she said, he says, I love you very much. And I said, why is he here? And she said, he came to see the baby. We had just had our son. Well, and then I said, does he want to tell us anything? And she looked around our apartment filled with toys and said, you guys need a bigger house. Now, my dad was an architect, so then that would be something he would have said. But, you know, I didn't have the experience. She did.
And do you think that she was influenced in a way by the work that you do?
I wasn't doing the work then. I really wasn't. And so, and the same thing with my son, who was 2. And at some point, I saw him go to the stairwell and stop and like sort of stare upstairs and look sheepish. And I went over to him. I said, what's the matter? And he looked up the stairs as if someone was there. And I said, I just instinctively said, is there somebody there? Did you see somebody? And he took me by the hand. He walked into the kitchen. He pointed to a photograph on the refrigerator of Luana, my friend, the actress who had died. And I said, oh, my gosh, you saw Luana at the top of the stairs? He nodded. And now I'm thinking, oh, my friend is here haunting my house and scaring people.
But she's not appearing to you.
No. But I said to him, does she scare you? And he looked at me and said, Dad, you can see right through her.
Oh,
like,
Lord.
You dummy. And then fishing for something, because I thought he'll never go upstairs again. I said, so does she say anything to you? And he looked at me, he said, she says, RJ, that's his name, RJ, I love you. And I said, well, that doesn't sound very scary. Yeah. And at that moment, like I had won an argument, he went, okay. And then he walked upstairs. My point is, he saw her. Now, he doesn't remember that. You know, he's like in a teen now. So, but the point is he had the experience of seeing her, of seeing right through her. I did not. I've only seen her in my deep hypnosis sessions, and I have seen her a lot in those sessions. And believe me, when you grab a hold of a hand of someone that you loved and knew, who is now appearing in front of you as a 20-year-old with a ponytail, but you can feel their hands and feel their energy, it's an experience. It's not something that you're hoping you could make up. And believe me, in a lot of this research that I'm doing, I hear things that are contrary to what I thought. So I'm asking them a question, or I'm with them, or I'm experiencing something, and they're telling me, well, it's not the way you think it is. So, you know, in your argument, it would be, of course, you know, if you're wishful thinking, you know, you're imagining these things, you're hoping, you know, that they're going to tell you the pot is at the end of the rainbow. Well, they don't say that.
Why do you think then they appear to children? Is it because children are closer to the transition? In other words, you know, they haven't long been in this world. Or is it that children are more receptive, and that as we get older, we get opinionated, we get set in our ways, and we get less inclined to believe?
Well, you know, I think those are two factors, but I think it's physiological. So the research I've done, the skull hardens about the age of 8. And if you look into this research, you'll find that the majority of children who claim to see or experience or remember things up to about the age of 8 is when they do so. And after that, they sort of lose it. However, not everybody does. And why is that? And if from a scientific point of view, if you look at Dr. Bruce Grayson, he's at the psychiatrist at the University of Virginia. He's sort of famous for the near-death experience work that he's done. He does a YouTube talk called "Is Consciousness Produced by the Brain?" And at the end of about an hour of this discussion and medical sites of different cases, he points out that it appears that the brain has filters and limiters, you know, the way a receiver does, like a stereo receiver. You get the signal, and then these filters block out unwanted things, and it moves into the places that it's supposed to so you can hear your sound. He's saying that the brain functions in that same way, that information that comes from elsewhere is parsed or filtered out until the brain doesn't function. And the cases that he cites in the study is in the UK, that 70% of the hospice workers who work with Alzheimer's patients reported that just prior to death, that their patients had suddenly recovered their memories, like a few minutes, maybe hours, maybe weeks before they passed.
It's incredibly common, and they recover lucidity.
Yes. And so his point is, it's as if the filters have died, because when they do the autopsy, the brains have atrophied to such a degree that they shouldn't have been able to remember anything, but they do. So it's like the filters that keep us from this information fall away. And those filters get altered for other reasons. Examples, near-death experiences, where the filters are somehow adjusted, or hallucinatory experiences. A friend of mine was in the hospital, and she, they put her in they did an operation, and she was in that kind of, you know, drugged state. And an orderly came in and sat with her for about a week. And every day he would come in and they talk about music. And she called him Mr. Jazz. And one day her family came in and she introduced them to Mr. Jazz. And then from the reaction on their faces, she realized none of them saw him. The idea is, and I've had many stories like this, but the idea was that in the altered state that she was in, as many people are near death, you know, as they're going to check into the next realm, it's like those filters are not functioning properly. That makes sense.
Yeah. And I think there's also maybe some connection between what you've just been talking about and what happens to us in the dreaming state or in the near unconscious sleeping state. I've got an example from my own life, and I might have told it years ago on the show, but let's tell it again, just quickly. Uh-huh. When my dad retired from the police in Liverpool, he ran a shopping mall, as you would call it, a shopping centre, as we call it here. And, you know, a lot of his work was security. He employed security guards there. And one of the guys that he employed was the nicest one. Some of them weren't so nice, but there was a guy called Billy there. And I've never forgotten Billy. I can even see him in my mind's eye now. But I remember falling, I was probably 19, 20, whatever, getting close to falling asleep one night, and I saw vividly floating in my sort of forehead area an image of Billy, dressed exactly as he would dress. He was always very precise about wearing the uniform. And with the uniform, he used to wear a little leather shoulder bag thing. I was never quite sure why. It was almost like the kind of thing that a parking attendant would have, but there was no reason for him to have that. But he used to wear this thing. I thought it was weird that I saw him in three. I was in that state between being awake and falling asleep, yeah. And I'd no reason to think about him. Why should I? He died not long after that.
Huh. So, well, let's listen. How much time do we have? I'm just curious.
We have as much time as it takes.
All right. Listen, and this is for the amusement, let's call it that, and the entertainment of your audience. But do you want to explore this? Here's what I've learned. I've learned that memory is holographic in the sense that, you know, how a hologram works. You take a photograph of something, but if you smash that hologram into pieces, each piece retains all the information from that original photograph. So memory has this weird thing, which I've seen it happen many, many times. And we can explore this if you want. And it's the idea of me asking you questions the way I would or the way a hypnotherapist would ask you questions. But we're going to do it without any sleep, other than the fact that you were up late last night and I was up late last night, whatever. But the idea of that we're relaxed because we're just having a conversation. You and I have never met before, but we can have this kind of profound conversation because you have touched upon something that I use in my work. I don't know if it's work, really, but in my investigation, which is you have a memory of something. You the rest of us listening don't know Billy, right? But you do. And so there's a way of us, if you want to, it's up to you, but we can investigate this further, which is to find out who is Billy, where is Billy, and how's Billy doing?
I can't even, I can't even remember his surname, and that's really bad. It'll come back to me.
Well, that's okay.
But I see him. It's
all right.
A real
so let's
strange thing.
Let's okay. just try. Let's hold on. This is an experiment, and it's an example. It may not work.
But the interesting thing about him, Rich, before we go there, is that at that time and now, apart from being somebody who I thought was a nice person, who was employed by my dad to work at the shopping center, I couldn't call him a significant figure in my life. I didn't understand then why he appeared in that way, if indeed he did. And I actually don't understand now why I'm referring to him. Only that he was not a relative. He wasn't a big player, but he was there.
Well, it's obviously Billy put us together today. So, that's the world I live in. Let's just allow it for a second. Speaking of Billy's, by the way, I just finished a film called Backstage Pass to the Flip Side, talking to Bill Paxton.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, I talked to Bill Paxton, who was a friend of mine, with three different mediums, okay? And I know it sounds weird, but let's just say in the midst of doing the kind of work I'm doing, Bill passed away. And, I'd known him for, 40 years. And so I thought, I wonder if he's going to show up. And I talked to three different mediums, Kimberly Babcock. I had lunch with her about something else. And I just thought, what the heck? Let's ask. And so I turned my camera on and I said, so I'd like to talk to my friend Bill. And she paused and she said, he's been waiting to talk to you. And then she went on to describe my friend Bill, how he passed, who was there to greet him, how he met his wife, which I knew because I had known him since then, how we had met in a pub in London. And then I thought, this is a source of unusual investigation. And I work with Jennifer Schaefer. She works with law enforcement agencies worldwide, nationwide, in missing person cases. She's very good at what she does. But she's also happens to be like a cell phone to the flip side. So I filmed her talking to Bill Paxton she didn't know who he was. I just said, I want to talk to my friend Bill. And then at some point, and it's on camera live, where she goes, why am I seeing the Titanic? And I said, well, ask him. She's like, was he on the Titanic or in the movie? And then I said, ask him. And she went, oh my God, he's giving me a thumbs up. And then a third medium, just this happened last week, Raylene Nunez, she was talking with Eric Meadows' mom, Dr. Elise Meadows, a friend of mine. And Dr. Meadows had contacted me out of the blue and said, you know, who do you want me to talk to? I thought I'd be, you know, just as a favor, I'll talk to somebody. I said, yeah, talk to my friend Bill. And I just, you know, finished watching that where Bill had very specific new information, stuff that he wanted to tell not only me, but his friends, close friends, et cetera, et cetera. And all I can tell you is, you know, so when you say the name Billy, that's what comes to mind. And, you know, I guess they all stick together on the flip side.
But this new Billy, information, right? Okay, the new information, is it of any use or is it trivia?
Well, think about it. Let's just parse that sentence for a second. So the new information is that we don't die, that we still exist on the flip side. I'll give you a good example. So
I'm kind of thinking along the lines of, you know, there's a $1,000 bill, or if there is such a thing as a $1,000 bill, stuffed down your sofa that, you know, you're going to get rid of that sofa. Make sure you get the money.
No, I have a perfect example for you, and it relates to you.
Okay.
Which is, so in Bill's case, he wanted to say something to his wife, okay? And it was so profound as he was saying it. I was there gobsmacked. And he had stuff that he wanted to say to me about my career and who I am and what I'm doing. All right. So all I can say is, a lot of times people on the flip side, they're not telling us the lottery numbers, you know, which you, like you just said, like $1,000. Hey, where's my money? They're helping us with our path. They're not allowed to disrupt our path. They can't change our journey. They're not supposed to.
How do you know they're not allowed? Who's told you that?
Examining 2,000 cases from Dr. Helen Wambaugh, from psychologists from New Jersey, 7,000 cases from Michael Newton.
Okay, the 45 but is there such what I suppose what I'm in my clumsy way I'm getting to is there such a thing as a prime directive like on Star Trek that you're not allowed to interfere with the natives on the planet?
Bingo. Exactly. And what's funny is when I've done 5 of these deep hypnosis sessions myself, and what I've learned frequently, especially when I'm filming a deep hypnosis session and somebody, let's say the hypnotherapist says, let's talk to your guide. And then the guy says, a person, you know, under hypnosis is saying, I'm being told I can't, I'm not supposed to. And then the hypnotherapist, in this case, it was Scott DeTamble. Scott would say, so what's the problem? And the person would say, my guide is telling me I'm not supposed to know this stuff right now because it'll alter my path, the path that I signed up to learn. So, you know, you sign up to learn these lessons and suddenly somebody comes in and starts shouting, it's only a play, you know, turning the lights on. It's only a play. We're only in a play here. That ruins the play.
So you're saying that, for example, you had your own experience where, you know, somebody that you'd been close to of 20, who'd been a prominent person, but you saw her as she was 20 and you knew her much later in her life.
Yeah.
She would have had information about you and what you were about to do, but would not be permitted to tell you very much about it because it would alter the way that you do things.
Correct.
That sounds very convenient, though, doesn't it? That sounds...
Well, hold on. What's funny about it, it's more complex than that. So, for example, when in Luana's case, before she died, she used to say to me, Rich, I think I'm going to another universe. And I said to her, what are you talking about? She said, I have this recurring dream that I'm in a classroom in another dimension. And she said, they're all speaking about spirituality in a language I've never heard before, but somehow I completely understand. Now, believe me, when she said that, I thought that's the morphine drip talking. She's obviously, she had cancer and, you know, obviously is making this stuff up. But the night she died, I got a call from a close friend of hers and said, I had this amazing dream about Luana last night. She was in a classroom in the fourth dimension, she said. Everyone was dressed in white, which is what she had said. Everyone in this classroom was dressed in white. And then I mentioned it to one of the hospice care nurses who said, oh my God, that was her recurring dream. She told it to me maybe a dozen times.
And you're saying that a third party also saw that?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. But hold on. So now cut to I'm trying to figure out what classrooms? What the heck is she talking about? I'm a complete skeptic in what she's telling me. But at some point, I pick up Michael Newton's book, Journey of Souls. And the first case is somebody saying, I'm in a classroom and everyone's dressed in white. And I thought, okay, ding. It was like a bell went off in my head. And I said, okay, I got to make a documentary about this guy to find out if this is accurate and to see if I can get to one of these classrooms. Now I'm filming in Chicago. I interview Michael Newton, who's retired. He doesn't want to go on camera, but I meet him and he goes, all right, I'll give you my last interview. And it was a 3-hour interview. We talk about this stuff. I start filming people under hypnosis. And Michael says, Richard, you know, why don't you film yourself under hypnosis and just see? And I thought, oh, this is a great way to prove this wrong, because I'm not here to be cured. I'm not here to prove there's an afterlife. I'm actually just trying to figure out what's going on. So I filmed this 4-hour session. And I thought, you know, if I don't see something, I'm not going to say I see something, because I'm here. I'm a skeptical filmmaker trying to show that it doesn't work. But that's not what happened. And I did see things, and I did find a lifetime that I was able to verify later on. But the most important thing is I went to her classroom, and there she was sitting in this class in the back of this room in like 20 years old, a ponytail. And her reaction to seeing me in the class, what would you think it would be?
You again?
Exactly. No, but it was, she was like, what are you doing here? Mm-hmm. Why are you here? And then I was trying to explain to her, well, I'm under hypnosis and I'm filming it, but I'm speaking aloud. And so I'm saying to the hypnotherapist, oh, I'm in a classroom and they're doing this class on a spirit. Wait a minute. It's about healing energy in the universe and how doctors and healers are able to tap into this source. And these students in this class learn how to help these doctors. And one of the students turns and looks at me and says, you don't know what you're talking about. And I thought, oh, this is weird. If I'm making this up, I just was chastised by a student. Like the whole class stopped, you know, while I was talking. Like, imagine if you and I were here talking and suddenly somebody appeared and said, well, they're on the radio now. I mean, that's what the experience was. And everyone in class stopped. The teacher stopped. They all looked at me. And my friend Luana was like, what are you doing here? And I said to the hypnotherapist, I don't think I'm supposed to be here, but it's a long way to get here. So I'll just tell you what I experienced, blah, blah, blah. So I go on and I talk. And then I point to the student who's glaring at me. And I said, you know, I understand that not everybody signs up to cure everyone, so that every doctor is going to cure a person by knowing what happens in this class. And not everybody signs up to be cured. Some people sign up for lifetimes where they want to examine the nature of the illness so they can become doctors in future lifetimes. Believe me, this was my first hypnotherapy session. I don't even know what I'm saying, but I'm saying it. Okay? I'm just saying those words. And that seemed to mollify the guy. And now, 2 years later, I'm in Los Angeles, and I thought, you know, I should try this again. Maybe I'll have a different experience. And I find this hypnotherapist, Scott DeTamble. Scott and I do this journey. He starts counting me down, whatever, back from 100. I get to 98, and I said, Scott, stop. I'm there already. I was right back in that classroom within a few seconds, except only 20 minutes had gone by. So I'm back in the classroom. Luana's holding my hand. She's standing in front of the teacher, and she's apologizing on my behalf. This is my friend Richard. He's doing a film. He's, you know, blah, blah, blah. I really want to apologize. You know, I hope it hasn't disrupted things. And then the teacher, who I'm looking at a person who's like 6 or 7 feet tall with a kind of a greenish tinge to his body, and he looks at me and says, what do you want to know? And so at that point, I'm thinking, wow, this is so bizarre. I'm here. This is new information to me. I had no idea that you could communicate with teachers or talk to classrooms. But I just start asking my questions. Well, what is the healing light of the universe? How do you do it? How do these people, what's this classroom about? So that's kind of been my journey. And so I was going to get back to something you personally said.
I'm just interested that you went back. Despite the fact that time had elapsed, you went to see another hypnotherapist and you went back straight to the same place just 20 minutes later.
Right. That's right.
Was that because you wanted to or you were meant to? I'm just intrigued as to why you went back there.
Well, no, the question really isn't why did I go back there? Because, of course, I wanted to. I did want to go back to see. I wanted to see if I would have a different experience. And I thought I would. I thought, oh, maybe I wasn't, you know, an American Indian and maybe I was something else. But I not only had that experience, I went back to the very moment. But point is, more interesting to me anyway, is time. Outside, once you're outside of time, in this other realm, time moves differently. You'll hear a lot of people say that time doesn't exist, but that's not what I'm learning in my research. What I learned is it feels like it doesn't exist because it's so relatively different. We all sign up for lifetimes. Each lifetime is in a linear fashion. Otherwise, we wouldn't learn any lessons. But ultimately, in this case, what I was experiencing was something that occurred 2 years earlier. Now it was, I don't know, maybe 20 minutes is too long. She literally walked me from the back row where she was sitting down to the front. That walk I have no conscious recollection of, but I'm experiencing standing at the front of the classroom with this teacher who's looking at me, very serious person, and saying to me, what is it you'd like to know? And what I've learned is this is frequently, we were talking to somebody on the flip side in an interview. It's somebody who had appeared in our interview maybe months before. And I said to him, what does it feel like to you talking to us 2 months ago and now we're talking again? And he said, it's like a comma. During one of the sessions I filmed for It's a Wonderful Afterlife, a woman said when she had the end of her 25-year lifetime here, it was in London, she found herself going back to this classroom, but she was the teacher. And she said, my class is all waiting for me. And it feels like I went out for 10 minutes. My 25-year lifetime feels like a 10-minute break.
And do you think the classroom motif, the classroom scene is symbolic for us? It is decoding something that we can't understand. It's just giving you a picture of a classroom because what is actually going on is something that we wouldn't be able to compute as human beings.
Well, I would agree with you if I thought that was the case, but no.
Really is a classroom and a teacher?
Yeah, well, I have no question in my mind because I've experienced a number of these classrooms. I'll tell you, the first classroom I went to was after I asked the sentence, the hypnotherapist said, where do you want to go? And I had remembered a previous lifetime. I had remembered the death from that lifetime. And he said, where do you want to go? Where do you want to go? And I said, I want to go home. And as I said it, I thought to myself, go home. And it turns out that's what everybody says. They don't say, I want to go to heaven. I want to go somewhere else. I want to go home. And I had the experience of being back with my friends and loved ones. And the hypnotherapist said, and my guide was there to greet me, this guy that I've never seen before in this lifetime, but I feel like I've known him forever. And he was there to greet me. And his reaction to greeting me was unlike anything I had read in all of the accounts and Michael Newton stuff where people would be in tears and there's my eternal teacher. In my case, it was like, oh, there's my pal. And he was looking at me like, are you okay? And I was like, yeah, I'm fine. And then the hypnotherapist said, where do you want to go? And I said, I want to go see my friends. And I was suddenly in a classroom, but Luana wasn't there. I walked into a classroom and there was a woman at the front of the class whom I've never seen before in this lifetime. I don't know her. I don't know who it is. Beautiful, beautiful person. I mean, you know, sort of in my mind's eye, I can see her now, but I mean, a very stunning sort of beauty. And she said, oh, my friend is here. And everyone in the class, and I'm a teacher, so I've been to a lot of classrooms. But in this case, there's about 20 or 30 people at desks, and they all turn around. And they're like, oh, my gosh, look, it's teacher's friend, you know, the way kids would look at you. And she says, what a wonderful thing that you're here. This is my friend Richard. I don't think she said Richard, but, you know, this is my friend. And then.
But how come you didn't know her?
I'm telling you, I don't know why I consciously don't know her, but over there I knew her. So you imagine, here's the thing. We only bring about a third of our consciousness to each lifetime. Two-thirds is always back home. So let's just leave that aside for a second. So when I'm talking to the hypnotherapist, I'm accessing the other two-thirds of my conscious energy. Let's just leave it there because that's how I can answer these questions. She says, the therapist says, where are we? Now, Richard conscious Richard says, I don't know. We're in a classroom. But the Richard over there says, this is a classroom of energy transformation. Everybody carries around all of the memories of all their past lifetimes in geometrical shapes. I'm repeating what I said. Geometrical shapes, they're fractals. They carry all of the information of all your previous lifetimes. They travel with us. And what happens is that people during their lifetime, energy gunk gets on these geometric shapes. And then this classroom here is to learn how to clean those geometric shapes. That's what I said. And as I'm saying it, consciously, Richard is saying, what? What are you talking about? But the Richard over there is acting like, yeah, this is normal information. And subsequently, I must tell you, you know, I've filmed 45 different deep hypnosis sessions, and I've heard it over and over again from people I've never met who say, excuse me, yes, we have these geometric shapes that sort of travel with us. And they contain their fractals, you know, which are mathematical equations, which contain all of the information of all our previous lifetimes. And we access this information when we need to. Okay. All I can tell you is that's what I said. That's what I experienced and saw. And if you do watch the movie Flipside, I have a little clip in there of a ball bearing factory, because that's what I said. I said, you know, they function as ball bearings, the way ball bearings work. And during, you know, a machine needs ball bearings in order to function, and that helps smooth the journey. And believe me, that is not an analogy that I could ever have come up with. First of all, I've never heard of geometric shapes, you know, traveling with us and being our memories, A. And then B, the idea that the analogy is that they're ball bearings. I mean, all I can tell you is that's very clever.
But, you know, as Karen Carpenter once sang, I never thought I'd quote Karen Carpenter in all of this,
oh,
but in your mind, we have capacities. You know, that line from Calling Occupants of Interplanetary Craft. How do you know that your mind, which is a remarkable thing, all of us, and we don't understand all of it by any manner of means, didn't create that somehow for you?
What you do is you compare it to other accounts. So, if you're in a courtroom and you have 100 different people and you're trying to figure out if there was an accident that happened, and you're the judge and you have all those 100 people tell you their story, each one is going to have a little bit of a different point of view. You know, I saw a red car. Somebody else says, I saw a blue car. At the end of the 100 pieces of testimony, you're going to have at least a picture that an accident happened, even though the details are different. So I'm comparing my personal experience with, let's say, 9,000 other people under deep hypnosis. And Dr. Helen Wambaugh's work was a decade prior to Michael Newton's. They never knew each other. They don't, you know, they were not friends. I don't know if he ever saw her work, but I know that she worked alone, or pretty much so. So her work mirrors his work, the same answers. And the point is, if it was something else, right? And this was the conundrum that I gave to the scientists at the University of Virginia when I was there and presented my research from Flipside. I said, look, take anybody off the street and put them under deep hypnosis. And if they say something different, then we're done here.
Yep. No, I get the point. If it was something else, why would there be such commonality between all of the accounts? Bingo. That's the fascinating thing. And that's the thing that really intrigues me. And that's the thing that gives me hope that maybe this isn't all there is, and there might be some more.
By the way, we talked to your mother the last time we were speaking with each other. Do you remember?
Well, I actually, do you know what? I don't know what, there are so many things going on. I cannot recall that part of the conversation. Can you call her up now?
Well, here's the thing. Here's what we did. I said to you, I was trying to give as an example that anybody can talk to anybody. That's what I've learned from this case, you know, from this research.
Yes, you put the onus on me. I remember. Okay, sorry. Tell the story.
No. And basically, we went away for a break. And you said, during the break, I asked my mother a simple question. What color car is Richard driving? And, of course, and she said green.
Green was the answer. I remember,
But green was the answer. And my car is like dark blue, right? It's like blue, green, whatever.
Yeah.
But I thought about that later on, and I just thought that was, it refers to the $1,000 on the couch scenario, which is, if you could talk to your loved ones, right? What would you ask them? Now, your loved ones are not omniscient. You know, they aren't all knowing. Of course not. They can only refer to what they can see or what they can experience or what they have experienced, because like those fractals that travel around with us, it just contains all of our information, not everybody else's information. So you can only access, and you know, they say the eyes are the window of the soul. And when I ask these questions to people on the flip side, so how can you understand what I'm saying, or how can you see what I'm seeing? And they'll always say, well, I'm, you know, they give the medium an image of being above somebody's head or looking out through their eyes. So the idea of seeing, so your mom couldn't possibly know what color my car was unless she was standing next to me.
But,
you see?
I mean, in your book, was the answer to the question right or wrong? I mean, blue is wrong. Not green, and green is not blue.
No, but in my book, why would your mother reply green, A, and B, she must be there thinking to herself, this is hilarious. My dear Howard, who I nursed and took care of, and he took care of me, and the one question he asked me that when he finally gets a chance to talk to me is, what color is some guy's car in Santa Monica? See, okay,
But it wasn't, at the end of the day, it was close, but not right.
No, not really. It wasn't. Well, as I pointed out, I was sitting in a car when I was talking to you, because you know, my phone thing works well in my car. I was looking out at green. Uh-huh. Everything was green from where I was sitting. I mean, there was, you know, the Palisades of Santa Monica. It was all green, 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 green. But the car itself is dark blue or blue green or something. But my point is, it's not to chastise your poor mother, which is to say, but what I want you and what I think your listeners should do is, when you're asking questions, try to be open to the possibility that you can ask questions. This came from Harry Dean Stanton, the actor who passed away. He was good friends with Paxton. I was friends with him. And he was a famous skeptic, a famous atheist, and he did not believe in the afterlife. And so it was hilarious when we did an interview with him just after he passed away. And he gave me specific details to go to his friends at his memorial service, which hadn't happened yet, and pass them along. Harry wanted me to tell you, you need to go see the doctor about your prostate. Harry wanted me to tell you that you need to take water with your arthritis medicine.
All right, let's zero in on the prostate case. Was that right?
Yes, it was absolutely correct. Okay. I went up to this guy at the memorial, and of course I said, now this is going to sound weird, but I was talking to Harry on the other side, and they looked at me like, what? Harry, you know, he didn't believe it. I said, that doesn't matter whether he believed in it or not. He says, you need to get your prostate checked. Hmm. The answer, I went for my first treatment today. The guy who I said, you know, you need your arthritis medicine that you're taking, you need to drink water. His son fell out of the chair and said, oh my God, it's what we tell him every day. So I couldn't possibly know those things. And all I'm saying is, it's not me. I'm not the guy. This was a medium, came through, you know, helped me access somebody I know. I'm just asking the questions.
Of course, if I was being a real hard-hearted skeptic here, and look, you know, I'm a starry-eyed want-to-believer, okay? That's what I am. So I'm not a skeptic or a hard-heart. I'm just a want-to-believer. In terms of prostate conditions, I was reading about them today. You know, they're very common in men over 50. So sure, it would be the kind of thing that you might ask a man over 50.
Yeah, except this particular person who if you knew who that was, and I'm not going to say who that was, it would be news worldwide.
Really?
Let's put it that way.
So
yeah.
I would know who this person is.
Everybody listening to my voice would know who this person is.
Oh my
but my
God.
Point isn't, I'm not here to out people. From the flip side, and you can imagine, when we have conversations with people on the other side, they say all kinds of things about their journey and their path that we don't know, that we didn't know. But my point, I'm not here to change or alter what their history was. I'm only here to say, look, they're accessible. Mm-hmm. So when you ask questions to your loved ones, ask them questions that they would know the answer to, but you do not.
Well, listen, I'm open-minded enough to do experiments, and sometimes they are laughably wrong in the way that they work out. But I've had this thought bugging me while we've been talking. And yes. It's to do, and this is going to be completely wrong, I'm sure it is, but you know, let's put it out there anyway. And maybe you might come back to me in a week. This is always the medium's get out, isn't it? Oh, you're going to come right. back to me and tell me this was true. Have you bought something for your kitchen?
What?
Something for your kitchen, a microwave oven.
Oh, you're asking me, you're accessing me, the martini.
Yeah, no, I just, there's a microwave oven. I don't know why I'm saying, but I've been bugged by this thought of a microwave oven.
But here's what I do with mediums. And the answer to your question is likely could be, I don't know, I have to think about it. But
all right, well, come back to me if that means anything.
Yes. But here's the thing. When something appears in a medium's eye, mind's eye, right? Because all they're doing is, here's why, because obviously vocal cords don't work once you're not on the planet. However, your brain retains the memory of a person's voice, and your brain retains the memory of what words sound like. And so what they do is they send an image, let's say while you're sleeping or dreaming, and that image gets sort of stimulated, and then you see, so then you try to interpret it. And that's what mediums are doing. They're interpreting things as best they can. Mm. Now, when they predict the future, I'm happy to say the future's not set. So they're trying to give you a likely outcome. Anybody who claims that they know what the future is inaccurate. They're giving you a likely outcome.
But if you're saying that there's birth, rebirth, and destiny, the future must be set, mustn't it?
There's birth, there's rebirth, and there's your journey. You choose the journey. You choose to come here and learn things, but it may not work out that way because of free will. You asked about the sacrosanct thing. Mm-hmm. That's it. Free will. You can change your mind. So you agree to everybody, and not you, but people agree to come here to have a lifetime to do the journey. And at some point they go, I can't handle it. I can't take this. This is too difficult. I don't know what I was thinking. I signed up for something much more difficult than I remember that it was going to be like. Mm-hmm. And they check themselves out. They leave the planet. And we're all at a loss for it because they've cheated their contract. They've broken the contract.
Are you talking about people who take their own lives?
Any version of that, or they drive into a car, they drive, off the road, or they fall asleep at the wheel. They do things that change the contract that they signed up for. Right. And what it does is it screws it up for everybody else. When they go back home, and this is where, I have these discussions with people. When they go back home, they're not chastised for doing anything because, of course, you can't kill anybody. Nobody dies. They go home. But when they get back home, all the friends who are there, remember, two-thirds is always back there, they're like, what did you just do? You ruined everybody's third act. We were all going to go to Rome. We were all going to be together. We were all going to connect. And the person who's done this is smacking their forehead and saying, oh my God, I forgot.
How does fate, or whatever you want to call it, how does fate fix that?
Well, I don't know what that word means. I mean, I know what it means is a theoretical thing. All I can tell you is what the research, what people say, which is we choose our journey. There's nobody else choosing our journey.
But we don't consciously do it, because I can tell you for nothing, as much as I love what I do and the supposed skills that I might have,
Howard,
I wouldn't have picked to do it this way.
Howard,
not in a thousand years.
Howard, I can walk you right into your counsel where you can see why you chose what you're doing, which is healing people with your voice. Let's just put it what it really is. Now, how do I know this? Because in my own session, I'm there talking to a council that I didn't know existed. I didn't believe existed, but here I was talking to them. And I said, so why did I choose Richard Martini? And my council laughed. And then they showed me an image of myself lying on a couch being filmed, because that's what was doing. I was filming myself on the couch. And they said, ask him. Ask Richard, he knows the answer. And I realized in that moment, they were talking about the third of me that was here, the Richard part. They were addressing the two-thirds that's back there. And what I also got from that is I had chosen to be a filmmaker because film can heal people. Laughter, the quickest medicine to make. And I actually said, laughter heals people. Crying does the same, but it requires catharsis. I've never used catharsis in a sentence, but I said it. So catharsis is that thing, you know, it takes a while to get through to the other side, and then you get the same effect that laughter does, but laughter more instantaneous. You can actually heal somebody by making them belly laugh. So that's why I chose this career as a filmmaker. But then I said, I just wish I had chosen somebody more successful at it, which got a laugh from the hypnotherapist. And it also got a laugh from my counsel on the other side. It's the only time in my life I've had laughs from two sides of the planet, you know, whatever, two sides of the realm. But the idea is, as I said then, I have a feeling that the filmmaking part is going to help the rest of it.
So look, if we all have a job to do, that's why you chose Howard. Well, okay, I take that part. Why couldn't it have been easier than it has been? I mean, I'm not expecting you to be able to answer that. I'm throwing that out as an idea. You know, why have on a podcast I can use words like crap? Why have I had to go through the crap that I've gone through then in order to do this? If I was picking it for myself, I'd have picked a much easier and, well, easier path where there was a little more money to be a little more comfortable, and I wouldn't have had to go through some of the things that I've had to go through. And I speak here for many other people who probably, you know, have been through similar experiences.
All right, let me see if I can take a stab.
Answer that one, Richard Martini,
yes,
if you can.
Yes, I can, my friend. Unfortunately, that's the problem with me. No, it goes to a discussion I was having with a former Tibetan monk, a famous author, and he said to me, because, you know, in Buddhism, they don't believe that you choose your lifetime. It's just, you know, karma. And he said, why would I choose to be born HIV positive in Africa in extreme poverty? Mm-hmm. And I said, which one of those ideas is a pejorative? Which one is negative? Mm. And his point was, well, you know, I wouldn't have chosen that. And I said, well, wait a second. When you're in the between lives realm and I come to you and I say, look, I need you. The reason I need you to be born in this part of Africa and poor and you're only going to live for like 6 years is because you're going to teach a profound lesson in love to all these other people, the doctors, the nurses, your parents. It's going to be a profound lesson in love and loss. Can you do it? Now, there's going to be a lot of flies. I got to tell you, when you're going to be there, it's going to be flies. But remember the time frame? 6 years here feels like 6 minutes over there. So can you give me 6 minutes of your existence to go and teach profound lessons in love and loss? Now, when I put it that way, it doesn't sound so bad. But what I've learned is the people who go through the biggest mountains, the most difficult journeys, are usually older souls. They're people who signed up for more difficult lifetimes.
Okay, and does this mean then that the journey's end comes at some point? You pull into the terminus and you don't have to keep coming back here.
Well, now let's examine that for a second. Got to keep coming back here. Why do people come here in the first place? Why do you think it is?
Well, I keep being told by people like yourself to learn and to assist others.
Ah, that's kind of boring. Come on. Who wants to go to class all the time? No, I agree with them. I'm just saying, what else is it? What's fun? What's fun about being here on the planet, let's say, as opposed to being not here?
I suppose contact with people. Of course it is.
All right. What else? Pizza?
Yeah.
Cappuccinos?
Pizza, holidays.
So this is one of the questions I ask, and I want you to ask your mother this question the next time it comes up. What do you miss about being here? This is a question I can't know the answer to. No, the medium can't know the answer to it either. What do you miss about being here? And I ask the question all the time. And what do they miss? Smell. They miss, you can create any thought. Any thought can create a tangible thing on the other side, a glass of whiskey, but you can't capture the taste. It's too complex. You can't capture the smell of the dew in the morning. You can't capture that smell when the rainstorm has just begun. You can't capture that smell of being out in the pasture, wandering around with the animals. You can't capture those things. The taste of spaghetti, noodles, you could do a good job of attempting it, but you just can't capture that flavor. And some people miss breathing, the idea of actually taking a full breath of fresh air, or I've heard driving in a car where the wind is whipping against your face. These things that we take for granted every single day are the reason we come back here.
So when you're in, I don't want to call it limbo, but what, you know, when you're in that space.
Home. Call it home.
That's okay, when you're home, home. You start home. Thinking, well, it would be fantastic to stand on a hilltop and look down on the ocean and feel the breeze upon my face.
Well, I would say it's usually like this. Your Howard's friends knock at your door and they come in and they go, all right, look, Howard, here's the plan. This next lifetime, here's what's going to happen. You're going to be in London. You're going to become this guy and you're going to heal people with your sound of your voice. It's going to be really cool. And you go, no, I've done that. I'm not interested in that. You remember the Viking era? We did that. I was the herald. I don't like being a herald. And they go, no, you're so good at it. Unless you play this role, I can't learn the lessons I'd like to learn. So they bleed upon you. They make you feel guilty about coming here so you can help them. Nobody comes here alone. They all come here with the agreement of everybody else, the Billies of the world. They all come with the same idea that we're all going to learn lessons.
And is it possible, and I've thought about this a lot,
yeah,
that, you know, like a lot of us, I'm closer to the end of the journey than the beginning. That's just a statistical fact.
Are you?
Well, I presume I am, you know, unless I'm going to live to 150, I guess
that
I'm...
Wait a minute, Howard, you're on stage, okay? You're on stage, you have your props, you have your dialogue, you kind of know where the play's going. What happens after the play's over?
Well, you go home and think about the next play, presumably.
You go home. Yeah, bingo. You go home and you work on the next play. You're never ending the journey. You're just ending the performance.
But all of this stuff, I mean, I don't want to personalize this, but I'm the only example I've got. You know, since I've committed all these years to doing all of this, I want to be able to progress. You know, in some ways, in some respects, I've been held back and, you know, some things have not happened the way they should have. I want more time and I probably won't get it. Would I be able to come back then and do this again, but not learn all the garbage along the way, but, you know, start from somewhere roughly where I am now? Would be kind of nice.
I'm sorry to laugh, but I think that's great. Listen, you know, it's really up to you. And then people ask me this question a lot, you know, would I do the same thing I'd be doing? Well, once you get home, you get to examine all the things that you did and all the people that you changed and the lives that you affected. Now, I'm sure you get emails like this, I do, where people write to you and say, I listened to your show, I listened to your voice, I listened to what you said the other day, and it changed my life. It helped me. It really helped me get from A to B.
I do. And, you know, it humbles me. It scares me, and I go away and I think, and I do get those emails, and, you know, my heart goes out to those people. I don't know what to make of it because I'm thinking I'm only me. How can I have any effect like that? How can that be possible?
I just want you to hold that thought for a second. Just get to the end. Don't go further. Don't put the comma in there. You just get to the end of that sentence, which is, I'm humbled by it. I've helped people, and it makes me feel good to do so. So if I'm saying to you, Howard, you and I are back in the between lives, and we're having this discussion, and I say, look, Howard, I think this would be great for you because you're going to help heal these people. You're going to have these other adventures. You're going to have your own cappuccinos and your own pizza, and you're going to live in London of all places because, you know, you used to live in California. You did that lifetime. This is going to be more fun for you because this is the result. Now, here's what people claim. When you get to the between lives realm, it happens in near-death experiences, not just under deep hypnosis. People have this experience of having a past life review, their lifetime review, where they get to see the people they healed, the people they helped. They also see the people they didn't heal and the people they didn't help and the people they hurt. So they get to experience all of that. But I've heard it so many times. David Bennett, a friend of mine who had a near-death event, and he wrote about it in a book called Voyage of Purpose. Scientist who died 12 minutes underwater. In between lives, he had this experience of them showing, his guides showing him So two things. One was a terrible bar fight in Texas, except he experienced the bar fight from the guy that David was beating up. So he had the experience of the humiliation, of the blood, of, you know, the, all of the emotion and anger that people had towards this poor guy. So he felt awful about that. But then he had this memory of helping this older woman who was just really dour and unhappy, and he took it upon himself to make this woman laugh. And then he said he saw what that laughter had done in this woman's life and how it had healed so many other people around her. So the person who writes you that email, you know what they say, an email represents 20, 100, sometimes 200 people. I had a woman come up to me at a book talk, and she was sitting in the back of the room, and I went up to her, and I won't get into why this happened, but she said, "I just wanted to look you in the eye and thank you for saving my life." And I thought, gee, as a film guy, I'll never get a review. Siskel and Ebert will never say, you know, that's not a review you're ever going to get in any kind of work that you're going
to
do.
Well, the one thing that so many of us want to be able to do with this life of ours, and we're coming to, sadly, the end of this conversation now, Rich, but we'll have to do this again. People want to make sense of it all. That people need to make sense of all of it, and that will be one way of doing it. Just at the very back end of this, and we have to be somewhat circumspect about how we talk about this.
Yeah.
Who would pick in that intervening period before the comeback? Who would choose to be Adolf Hitler? Who would choose to be Saddam Hussein? Who would choose to be, you name some infamous figure from history.
Genghis Khan.
Who would choose?
Let's not forget Genghis Khan.
Who would choose to be a murderer? Who would choose to be Charlie Manson?
Well, here's the thing. I can't answer that question because the only people who can answer that question are those people themselves. But I can tell you this. When I first began this work, and I'm filming Flipside, the documentary, and it's in the documentary, and now I'm with Michael Newton, and they're doing a class, and I've interviewed Michael, and they say, you know, bring your camera in, and you can film a between life session. Jaded skeptic that I am, I sit down with my camera, they introduce me, there's about 50 people in the room, and this hypnotherapist does Paul Orend, former president of the Newton Institute. He's doing this session with a woman who, from Sedona, who actually is a hypnotherapist. This is the first time she's ever done this demonstration publicly. She told me later she did not remember this lifetime until this moment. She remembered dying in Auschwitz. And Paul Orend took her to that last moment, but then he took her, as they do, let's go to a happier time in your life. And she went back to when she grew up in Warsaw. And by the way, I found this woman's name in the records from Auschwitz. And she described, you know, a happy life and then how everybody had been taken from her. And then those last moments being in the showers. And then she goes to home. She was the first person I heard say that word. I want to go home. And she goes home, and now she sees her guides and all her loved ones and all of her family, by the way, all the people, some of whom are in this lifetime as well. And at some point, she gets to see her counsel and guides, and she says to them, why? Why did I choose such a difficult lifetime? And she pauses and says, they're showing me, this is going to be hard for me to express, but they're showing me that it was more difficult to choose to play the role of a perpetrator than a victim in this lifetime. And the jaded skeptic that I am, my head shot back from the camera and I looked around the room. It was easily the most politically incorrect thing I've ever heard in my lifetime. But this bears out within the research. So she then said, every day in the camp was an intense lesson in compassion, in courage, in forgiveness, in helping. And she said, but I know it sounds weird, but from my perspective, I'm glad that I chose that role instead of what other people chose to play the role. When you go to the theater and you watch people who play the bad guy, they're playing the bad guy, and you can't help but hate them. But when they get off stage, you know, Juliet doesn't strangle Romeo and say, why'd you leave poison for me? Romeo says, it's in the play. This is what the thing is. And so I know it's hard for people to sort of, it sounds like I'm mitigating it. I'm not. I would never choose those roles. I couldn't do it. I avoided that era. But I can tell you that in this research, people consistently say that no matter what the role is, you know, it wasn't just Hitler. There was all those people who participated, all those people who did awful, terrible things. The only people who can answer that is why? Why did you do that?
But and it is the thought that somebody could choose, all right, we know that they're a soul or whatever you want to call them, could actually opt to be something, someone so unspeakably evil who would have such a devastating effect not only on individuals' lives but on the entire world. I think that's a thought that's really hard to grapple with, and we really don't have time or scope to discuss it here, really.
Well,
but
in a nutshell, Michael Newton's work, he did talk about people who, when they got back and they did a life review, their guide said, look, we're going to isolate you for a while now. And they would go voluntarily into like a place of complete darkness where they didn't see anybody else for, I don't know, millennia. But the idea is that they would have to examine why they chose the lifetimes they've chosen, which are difficult. So it's not, and like I said, people experience all the negativity that they engendered. So you can imagine whoever commits heinous crimes feels the victim's pain when they get back there. So that's
all things are in balance, but I suppose it begs a question that, again, we don't have time to discuss, but it is another fundamental question here as to why, if there is a force of good up there in heaven or wherever it might be, how do they permit evil? But we can't answer that. That's not a question we can answer here, but it's a question that...
It's not in the research. No. I can just tell you, in the thousands of cases, they say there's no Satan, there's no evil that exists on the flip side. I'm sorry, I wish I could tell you differently. It's here on this planet where we live in a polarized world, negative, positive, where we experience these things. Okay. It's here.
That takes me... Listen, I often quote my dear, wonderful Liverpool grandmother, who had a fantastic turn of phrase, and sometimes quite, as we call it here, quite fruity language. But she used to say to me, you know, if I was ever frightened as a child, she would say, listen to me, son, it's not the dead you've got to be afraid of, it's the living. And I think once again, we come back to Edna was her name, her great wisdom. Rich, we're out of time. We'll continue this conversation.
We're going to talk to Billy and Edna the next time we talk.
I think so too. And check for that microwave oven. It's probably complete nonsense, but it was just something that, you know,
I would say break it down. It might have something to do with you. It might have something to do with somebody listening in.
Well, they're listening on their microwave. Who knows? Anything could happen. The wonders of technology.
Oh, maybe that's what turned off the sound earlier.
Well, and the Internet of Things, of course. Everything's connected these days. But look, you're talking to a man who's had about 3 hours sleep after I did the radio show last night. So, maybe my portals are open, or maybe I'm just not thinking as clearly as I might. Rich Martini, if people want to read about you and your work, where do they go online?
RichMartini.com, and my books are available, Hacking the Afterlife, It's a Wonderful Afterlife, Flipside, and Backstage Pass to the Flipside. They're all available.
Good to talk with you. And this time we didn't have to take breaks for commercials and stuff like that. We just talked.
Thank God.
Yeah. We love radio and we love commercials, but there's a place for those things. Thanks, Rich, very much.
On the flip side. Thank you, Howard. Have a good one.
And I'll put a link to Rich Martini's work on my website, theunexplained.tv, which was designed and created and maintained, and a troubleshot by Adam Cornwell at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool. Any problems with getting the shows, any problems with the new website, Adam is the guy to go to. And also tell him if you like it, please, because he loves to hear from you when you tell him that. But he loves to hear from you anyway, and so do I. You can get me at mail@theunexplained.tv. And when you contact me, don't forget, tell me who you are, where you are, and how you use this show. Thank you very much if you have been in touch recently. More great guests coming soon here on The Unexplained Online. So until next we meet, my name is Howard Hughes. I am in London. This has been The Unexplained. And please, whatever you do, please stay in touch. And please stay safe. Please stay calm. And like I've just said, please stay in touch. It's been a long day. Take care. Bye-bye.